It is Monday, May 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, officials from the United States and North Korea negotiate on a possible summit between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Italian politics plunges into chaos.
Italian politics, famously chaotic, but no one has ever seen anything quite like this before.
And Americans remember their war dead on Memorial Day. It's all ahead. South Korean President Moon Jae-in Monday suggested his impromptu get-together Saturday with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un could herald more such meetings to, in his words, expedite faster advancement of inter-Korean relations. He even suggested he could participate in a three-way summit with the North and the United States next month. That summit appears for now to be back on track, with U.S. and North Korean diplomats meeting at least through Tuesday at the truce village of Panmunjom. The U.S. delegation is led by veteran State Department Korea expert Sung Kim. President Donald Trump cast doubt on the summit Thursday when he called it off, but then quickly announced it could be back on track. Tufts University professor and chair of the Kim Koo Korea Foundation, Sung-Yoon Lee, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, Mr. Trump should have held firm and not agreed to take part in Singapore until Pyongyang offered meaningful concessions.
Now the U.S. has gotten North Korea to chase after the United States instead of the North Koreans calling the shots. It's very much in the North Korean strategic playbook. They agree to meetings, they agree to agreements, and then violate them, and then cancel meetings, walk out right in the middle of negotiations, and they are able to get the other party, often big powers like the U.S., sort of hanging, chasing after North Korea. And of course, in interpersonal relations, in secular life, the party that plays hard to get always enjoys the greater leverage.
How do you account for the president's withdrawal and then reinsertion of the U.S. into a proposed U.S.-North Korea summit?
Well, I think the president always wanted to effect the summit meeting. He wanted to meet with Kim Jong-un, perhaps moved by hubris or an underestimation of the North Korean leader, or even dreams of winning the Nobel Peace Prize. He has shown much zeal, eagerness in meeting with the North Korean dictator. So I think he grew a little fed up that the North Koreans were a no-show in the preparatory meeting scheduled in Singapore. I think he was insulted perhaps by North Korea's harsh rhetoric in recent days by Kim Kye-kwon and Madam Choi, Choi Son-hee. But of course, he has been called a mentally deranged dotard in response to his name calling of Kim as a rocket man on a suicide mission. So the latest vile rhetoric or disparaging remarks are not really anything new. So I think he was showing his frustration and maybe doing a bit of posturing. And I guess that was effective because Trump's very discourteous letter snubbing Kim Jong-un, canceling the show, the summit meeting, engendered an uncharacteristically civilized North Korean response. But it was a very short-lived leverage because in 24 hours, President Trump changed his mind.
A U.S. diplomatic team is at the truce village of Panmunjom meeting with North Korean counterparts. Obviously, they're preparing for this potential summit coming up next month. But the two sides completely disagree, I believe, on the definition of what denuclearization means.
In North Korean mind, denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula means really the abrogation of the U.S.-South Korea alliance, complete expulsion, eviction of U.S. troops and U.S. military assets from the Korean Peninsula. The U.S. has something very different in mind, of course. Sung Kim, as we know, is a former U.S. Special Representative for North Korea Policy, as well as U.S. Ambassador to South Korea. He knows the technical stuff. He knows, you know, what to do and what to say. At the same time, his counterpart reportedly is Madam Choi, Choi Son-hee, a daughter of a former North Korean premier, whose strong words led to President Trump's cancellation of the summit. So, in a way, the U.S. is kind of normalizing Ms. Choi and the North Korean state, Choe Son-il, threatened, quote, nuclear-to-nuclear showdown, and to sit down with her, to have a high-ranking U.S. official to negotiate with her in person just a few days later, does send the wrong message.
Sun-Yun Lee, Tufts University professor. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Nigerians are asking how millions were being spent for the Safe Schools Initiative. Pakistan bans a former spy chief from traveling abroad. Nigerians observe lives lost to violence. And Myanmar's anti-corruption fight gathers steam. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study published in the journal Cell Metabolism suggests cutting back on calories in the daily diet may not only benefit the obese, but also those who aren't looking to lose weight. Analyzing data from the calorie or comprehensive assessment of the long-term effects of reducing intake of energy trial, the study authors found that aging and metabolism slowed in those who decreased their daily caloric intake by 15% over a 2-year period. They discovered that restrictions in calorie consumption also provided some protection against neurological conditions considered to be age-related, such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases, as well as others like cancer and diabetes. Past research indicates a slower metabolism can be beneficial for healthy aging and perhaps a longer life. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we hear how the trade dispute between the U.S. and China creates twice the headache for the United States' agriculture industry. Italy's political crisis continues as populist leaders halted their efforts to establish a government after President Sergio Mattarella rejected the choice of a Eurosceptic to become the country's economy minister. Jamie Detmer in Rome speaks with me about the political turmoil.
Well, we've had more than 80 days of negotiations about having a government since the March elections, which, of course, there was a hung parliament. But the big winners were the populists, the anti-establishment five-star movement, and the anti-immigrant League Party. And we had these negotiations prolonged and going on. It looked like last week we were heading to the first all-populist coalition government in Western Europe since the Second World War, virtually. But it all fell apart this weekend when Mattarella, who has the power to do this, absolutely refused to approve their choice of economy minister, a Eurosceptic who is against Italy remaining within the Eurozone system, in other words, having the euro as its currency. He adamantly refused to approve him. So the populist leaders pulled the plug on the negotiations. The prime minister designate resigned, and now Mattarella has turned to Cattarelli. I mean, this has prompted really what is a constitutional crisis. We have had previous presidents refusing to accept or approve a nomination for a ministerial job, but 3 times in the past, but never as in such a confrontational time as now. So we had the populace now saying that the president should be impeached.
Is there any likelihood of that?
Well, things are very unclear in Italy. Look, we've had more than 60 governments in Italy since the Second World War. Italian politics, famously chaotic, but no one has ever seen anything quite like this before. And it's very unclear how this proceeds. It is possible they could get a vote in parliament to impeach him. Together, they have a majority in the lower house, but they only have a slim one in the Senate, just about 7 seats. Most people think the impeachment won't happen. The bigger question is whether Cattarelli can get a vote of confidence sometime in the next week by the parliament. If he can, then he says he will try to keep this caretaker government going on until early 2019 and then hold new elections. And if he can't get a vote of confidence, He will limp on until September and October, and then we'll have early elections then. The big worry is that we had a very bad-tempered and violent election in March. People fear it could become even uglier and possibly more violent as a result of what happened this past week.
And Cottarelli has a reputation. He's known as a Mr. Scissors, apparently, for some of his promoted spending cuts.
Yes, but on the other hand, yes, I mean, at the IMF, he's kind of famous for that. But in the past, when we've had technocratic governments, we've had quite a few, actually, in Italy the past few years, they've all had to cut public expenditure. Italy is the second most indebted Eurozone country, after Greece, of course. And public expenditure has been too high. It breaches the budgetary rules of the Eurozone as well. So people are not surprised that he will need to start cutting. Equally, on the other side, the populists have wanted an extraordinary expansion of public spending, which was going to put them on course for a conflict with the European Union.
As you said, the Italian politics has been, there have been so many governments since the Second World War. But this sort of recent situation in Italy, what is the reaction from, say, the man or woman on the street to this continuing volatility?
Fear, above all. One of the reasons the populists did well in the last election was a high level of desperation amongst ordinary people about their economic situation, about the future of Italy, about jobs for their kids, etc. So they are very, very concerned about where this is going. And there's also an element of bewilderment as well, in that they seem, well, half of the country voted for change, and we're back having a caretaker government and the old guard of the political establishment back in control. It's going to be interesting to see in the elections how that plays out, whether the populists can capitalize on that and expand their majority, or whether we see possibly an alliance between the old man Silvio Berlusconi and Matteo Renzi of the Democrats coming together to form an establishment coalition to try to keep the populists out. We are in very unclear waters at the moment, very dangerous waters for Italy, and it could trigger some kind of Eurozone debt crisis, some kind of contagion as a result of what's going on here.
Jamie Detmer reporting from Rome. As tensions are easing over a potential trade war while negotiations between the U.S. and China continue, the uncertainty about tariffs and the eventual impact on the U.S. agricultural industry is taking a toll on U.S. farmers heading to the fields to plant this year's crops. As VOA's Kane Faraba reports, there's a lot at stake, not just for farmers, but also for the companies that supply them.
It's been almost two decades since Illinois farmer Scott Halpin's family drove a newer tractor through the fields of Grundy County. Thankfully, the equipment his family uses is well-serviced and, so far, reliable. Hopefully that doesn't change anytime soon, because Halpin says he can't afford it.
Not under this farm economy.
The iconic green and yellow tractors the Halpins own are made in America by John Deere, headquartered in Moline, Illinois. John Deere saw a surge in sales and profits in the early part of 2018, but that was before aluminum and steel tariffs were imposed by the U.S. on China. Now Deere, which uses steel in its equipment, plans to increase prices for 2019 models to protect profits. That means it won't be getting cheaper for Halpin to make a new purchase.
The increased cost of equipment with the declining farm economy right now doesn't make it real smart for us, or doesn't make it what we want to do for our farming operation here.
For companies like John Deere and Caterpillar, they really get hit on both sides of the trade dispute spectrum.
Mark Grivicheski is an investment advisor with the Quad Cities Investment Group, and explains that the cost for farmers and their suppliers to do business expands beyond the additional tariffs of 25% on imported steel and 10% on imported aluminum imposed by the U.S.
So if John Deere makes a routine purchase of $10 million of imported steel, they now have to cut another check for $2.5 million to the federal government, and that increases their operating costs. On the other side, you have China threatening the U.S. with $150 billion of their own tariffs, primarily targeting the U.S. agricultural industry. Not only does that impact farmers, but it impacts those companies with ties to the farming industry.
Increased costs for farm equipment and concerns about competitive access to a big market like China, which has depressed prices for corn and soybeans, is creating the perfect economic storm for farmers like Halpin.
The decline in the market has a daily effect on every farm in this country.
So does the relentless news about renegotiating trade deals and tariffs. What Halpin says he wants most, almost as much as favorable weather this year for his crops, is some sense of stability.
With the negotiations the way they're happening, it can hurt when things happen on a daily basis. It's just kind of uncertain times here in farming.
A time when, even before new tariffs, the United States Department of Agriculture projected net farm income in 2018 to reach a 12-year low. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Moline, Illinois.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Well, the United States is observing Memorial Day today, Monday. Many Americans have the day off from work and school. The three-day weekend is seen as the unofficial start of the summer vacation season. Officially, Memorial Day, observed on the last Monday in May, has been set aside to honor all who died during military service throughout U.S. history. Congress declared Memorial Day a national federal holiday in 1971. Observances around the country are planned for the day. President Donald Trump participated in a wreath-laying ceremony at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier at Arlington National Cemetery and addressed a commemoration there.
Each of the markers on that field, each of the names engraved in stone, teach us what it means to be loyal and faithful and proud and brave and righteous and true. That is why we come to this most sacred place. That is why we guard these grounds with absolute devotion. That is why we always will remember. Because here, on this soil, on these grounds, beneath those fields, lies the true source of American greatness, of American glory, and of American freedom. As long as we are blessed with patriots such as these, we shall forever remain one people, one family, and one nation under God.
At the cemetery, which is just outside Washington, thousands of flags wave proudly at tombstones. For more than 60 years, the Army Ceremonial Unit, known as the Old Guard, has been placing the flags at grave sites in the huge military cemetery. VOA's Deborah Block takes us to the annual tradition known as Flags In.
Soldiers walk across Arlington National Cemetery to place flags in front of more than 230,000 tombstones. The flags honor the members of the armed forces who are buried here, many who gave their lives to defend their country. Here lies a 21-year-old soldier killed during the war in Iraq in 2011. His younger brother wanted to come here to deliver the flag himself.
I love you. I'm sorry. And I miss you every day.
I hope I made you proud.
The cemetery is adjacent to an Army base, also the home of the Old Guard, the Army's 3rd U.S. Infantry Regiment. This means these soldiers can visit the gravesites of friends, family, and fellow soldiers they once served with.
I do visit them more than just on today. Like every couple of weeks, I'll come out and have a chat during lunch.
Boot by boot, and with great care, the soldiers place a flag to honor a fallen comrade. For this soldier, it is a moving moment to be part of Flags In for the first time.
To just see how many people lost their lives and to be able to put a flag on their tombstones, it means a lot to me.
U.S. Vice President Mike Pence also came to show his respect. And as the commander of the Old Guard quietly inserts flags on each grave, he tells us every soldier is significant.
We're all soldiers, and it's our ability to honor those that have gone before us. And to be able to do this for those families that can't be here is really important.
The flags stand in honor of these fallen soldiers, a tribute to their sacrifice. Deborah Block, VOA News, Arlington Cemetery.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Today, some 815 million people suffer chronically from hunger. And although this is significantly fewer people than the numbers we saw a decade ago, hunger still kills more people than AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria combined. On May 28th, we observe World Hunger Day. It is an effort to focus attention on the fact that despite a sufficient availability of food nearly everywhere, globally some 21,000 people die every day from hunger or malnutrition. People do not go hungry because the world does not produce enough food for everyone. According to the World Hunger Education Service, over the past 3 decades, significant growth in food production, along with improved access to food, helped reduce the percentage of chronically undernourished people in developing countries from 34% to 15%. The principal problem is that many people in the world still do not have resources to purchase or grow enough food. Indeed, hunger is a consequence of poverty and also one of its causes. Hunger exists because many countries lack social safety nets, because in many countries women, although they do most of the farming, do not have as much access as men to training, credit, or land. Conflict, governance systems that do not encourage investment in agriculture, poor management of land and natural resources, lack of educational opportunity, displacement of small farmers by natural disasters, and financial and economic crises that eliminate jobs at the lowest levels all contribute toward creating conditions that push the poorest into hunger. Over the past decade, a global push to reduce hunger and extreme poverty has marked some significant successes, thanks in part to the efforts of numerous international and transnational institutions, foundations, NGOs, and governments, including the United States. But on World Hunger Day, let us not forget that with over 815,000 people still living in daily food insecurity, we still have a long way to go before we can safely say that no child goes to bed hungry most nights, that no parent skimps on their own dinner so that children can eat.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.